Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome, everyone, to this Featured Voices podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and it is February 26th, 2019. Momentous changes are afoot economically and politically, and so much is going to depend on the decisions that we make, both individually and collectively. So it's more important than ever that you pay close attention to what the political and monetary elites are up to. The so-called deep state is now exposed, and instead of running for cover, it's doubling down. Well, and that's their style, of course. Meanwhile, the central banks, but especially the U.S. Federal Reserve, are back to pausing and easing and jawboning and printing even after a single month of stocks failing to go upwards. The weakest post-recession expansion in history is very long in the tooth, and an abundance of data suggests a recession is right around the corner, which would prove disastrous as neither the fiscal or monetary authorities have any runway left to gain any altitude in this story. Back with us today to discuss all of this and much more is Mr. David Stockman, economic policymaker, politician, speaker, and financier. And as I'm sure you know, Mr. Stockman served as the director of the Office of Management and Budget in the Reagan administration and was the youngest cabinet member of the 20th century. He is the author of The Great Deformation, which we discussed with him last time, subtitled The Corruption of Capitalism in America. I can't wait to get some updates on that, given all that's happened since. That came out in April 2013, and it was really just an amazingly fact-filled, blunt, sometimes delightful and deservedly scathing examination of the various fiscal and policy blunders that have really degraded our future hopes and hopes for prosperity. Well, he's got a brand new book out titled Peak Trump, The Undrainable Swamp, and the Fantasy of MAGA. David, thank you so much for joining us again today. Welcome back to the program.
Very happy to be with you, Chris, and also I appreciate you summarizing the current outlook so well. That's essentially what I've addressed in Peak Trump, so I think we're ready to dive into some pretty important issues.
Well, and I can't wait because they are really super, just incredibly important right now. So, David, with the president embracing a financial bubble that you say is doomed for failure, he may be setting himself up for a legacy of being responsible for the next financial crisis. How do you see this playing out throughout the remainder of his term?
Well, I think that's exactly right. As I say in the book, I think he made a tremendous rookie mistake by not recognizing where he was in the economic and credit and Fed cycle when he was sworn into office, and essentially pivoting from, you know, decrying the current circumstance as one big, fat, ugly bubble, which he said over and over and during the campaign through November 2016, and yet within days of being inaugurated, he was embracing the economy, embracing the stock market as a vindication of his policies that hadn't even, seen any kind of implementation at all. Now, what I say in the book is it's important to look at cycles. And the inauguration was in month 90 of the third longest at that point business cycle in history and by far the weakest. At that point, GDP was up only 13% from the peak, pre-crisis peak, way back in the fall of 2007. By contrast, during the other two long cycles, the guns and butter cycle of the 60s and the tech boom of the 1990s, GDP was up 40 to 45% by month number 90 of a cycle. And even in those two cycles, within months, both of them ended. Now, if you look at it rationally, Trump was elected for a 48-month term, which means his first term would end in month 138, number 138 of this current cycle. And the key kind of newsflash about all of that is we've never been there before. In all of American history, there's never been a business cycle or expansion that lasted that long. So what I say in the book is the U.S. economy, facing all the headwinds around the world that we know about, unlike the tailwinds that, impacted the economy in the late 1990s, facing all these headwinds, the U.S. economy had recession written all over its forehead. And he should have been positioned like Ronald Reagan was in 1981 to blame the inherited mess on Jimmy Carter, which he did over and over and over, so that, you would take the steps to address, these huge bubbles. He should have tried to basically puncture that bubble and get the trauma of adjustment over, but instead he embraced it. And, the point I make is 800 points later, he denounced the Obama economy when the S&P 500 was 2140 right before the election. At 2940, which I call the peak, and that's where we get the title of the book, Peak Trump, on September 20, last fall, all of a sudden, 800 points higher, the big, fat, ugly bubble had been a ringing endorsement of policies that were so wrong-headed that he had been attempting to implement for the first 2 years. I call those policies, Trump's four wars on the American economy. And, the first one is trade war, is really a war on consumers that can't possibly make America great again. The second one is his border war on immigrant labor, which we desperately need because the native-born workforce is now actually shrinking just as the baby boom, surges into retirement. The third war is the political war on the Fed, which is upside down. They were finally trying to screw up the courage to normalize after dithering and delaying and ducking for years and years. And then the fourth war is really the war on national solvency. It's incredible that in year 10 of a business expansion, already in its last days, the Trump and the Republicans in Washington chose to massively increase the deficit to this year. The borrowing requirement will be in the order of $1.2 trillion, 6% of GDP, 10 years into a business expansion, unheard of historically, never really even contemplated before. And yet that's exactly what they did at the very time the Fed was finally beginning to pivot, to use that word, to QT and from the long period of quantitative easing. And that really meant they were dumping, for the first time in history, really, bonds back into the market at a $600 billion annual rate. That was the policy for this fiscal year. At the same time that the Treasury, Uncle Sam, is attempting to borrow $1.2 trillion. Now, that means there's $1.8 trillion of homeless bonds looking for a place to land in the bond pits of Wall Street, as I call it. And they will land, but it's a question always of price. It's always a question of what yield clears the market. And I can't believe that a 2.7% yield, barely above inflation, is going to clear the market once it becomes obvious that these deficits, the Trump deficits, aren't going to go away, and that when the recession hits, we're going to be borrowing somewhere in the range of $2 trillion on an annual basis. We'll be in totally uncharted waters. So, that's kind of a summary of, some of the factors that, lead me to conclude that peak Trump happened last fall, and there's a big slide downhill from here.
So, David, a wonderful summary of that. And of those four wars, I'd love to get to all of them. We'll get to the undrainable swamp in just a minute. First, let's complete this idea, though, picking on one of those wars, the war on the Fed. It seems to me that Trump, and again, this is just my personal observation. I could be wrong about this, but one of the things I've noticed is that he seems to be almost like day trading the market. I will notice that one of the wars you talked about, which is the trade war, Trump has very conveniently timed tweets that manage to come out pretty regularly talking about how great things are going with China. And every time the so-called stock market, I need air quotes around that word market, it doesn't feel like a market anymore, seems to respond. All the algorithms get excited and they chase it higher. Hundreds of S&P points seem to be solely the result of Trump's tweets at this point in time. Looking at that, is Trump's war with the Fed really about what the Fed is up to? Does he understand truly where we are in this cycle? Or is he just looking for a higher stock market?
He's just looking for a higher stock market, and he's exercising his historic view that is the view of a leveraged lifetime, leveraged real estate speculator in New York City who spent a lifetime borrowing money and writing essentially the financial bubble, the real estate department of that financial bubble that the Fed has been creating since the 1980s. So, you know, he calls himself a low interest man. He has no comprehension whatsoever, zero, nix, nada, nothing of what monetary policy and central banking is all about. The point I make in the book is that the number one, number two, number three problem that he inherited was central bank dominance of the financial system, the falsification of financial asset prices, the irrational and unjustified pursuit of 2.00% inflation year in and year out, because that's essentially inflated the cost structure, the prices and wages in the American economy, made us increasingly less competitive against China and the whole, supply chain that's connected to it, and resulted in the massive offshoring of production and good jobs and manufacturing and increasingly even services, now that you have the India price to contend with as well as the China price for goods. So I think, the whole mess we have stems from monetary central planning, Keynesian policy at the central bank. And unless you were willing to clean house at the Fed as the starting point, there was never any hope of making America great again, of MAGA, as he called it. And that's why also in the subtitle of my book, I call it The Fantasy of MAGA. You can't make America great again with trade wars and border wars and massive increases in the deficits and even easier money than we've already had. Those are totally the wrong solutions.
So before we get to those solutions, let's go to the rest of that subtitle there. What do you're referring to an undrainable swamp in here. Can you elaborate on that for us?
Well, I think it means a number of things. But number one, I learned a long time ago when I was budget director and even before that as a member of Congress that the real deep end of the Washington swamp is on the Pentagon side of the Potomac. And, what Trump has done is basically taken a defense budget at $600 billion that was already swollen with waste and far beyond anything you need for a homeland defense. And I have a whole section in the book about how a homeland defense wouldn't cost $600 billion that he inherited, or now the $700 billion that we have, $720 billion actually, that after two huge Trump increases. But you could do an honest, effective, and safe homeland defense for $250 billion. So by putting all of these funds into the DOD and into, you know, an even larger intelligence budget, which is already $75 billion and bigger than the entire Russian military budget for everything, he has actually fed the monster. Because remember, you know, the real walking around dollars that create the prosperity in Washington and all of the, you know, lobbies and NGOs and think tanks and all the rest of it comes out of the DOD, National Security, State Department, intelligence community budget. That, and it becomes a self-perpetuating lobby for its own. You know, ultimately, if you add everything up, $800 billion per year fleecing of the taxpayers. Domestically, yeah, we have, there's a huge amount of waste in the domestic budget as well, but most of it's entitlements, and so it's cash flowing out to all places, you know, across America, and those entitlements need to be reformed, but the impact on governance and what he rightly called the swamp comes from the national security side, from the warfare state, not the welfare state. And, you know, he's obvious. So it was a nice phrase, but unfortunately, he's embraced policies that go in just the opposite direction. It made the swamp even far deeper than it already was on the warfare state side of the equation.
Well, David, I'd like to explore that with you because you've got this insider's view of how DC really works. And I let me confess right up front to having a soft spot for anybody who is going to want to be a disruptor of the status quo in DC. Trump on the campaign trail seemed to have at least a role to play on in that dimension. But after he installed Bolton, Elliot Abrams, Nikki Haley, other rank-and-file neocon hardliners, I had to ask myself exactly what's going on here. David, it seems to me that these are loathsome errand boys and girls of the deep state, and they indicate to me that either Trump was never really actually a disruptor or was just too far out of his league to play ball. How do you interpret his hires here?
Well, you know, that's really a good question, and that's part of my thesis about peak Trump. He did have the right impulses and kind of a inchoate and primitive formulation that our security was not dependent, our national security should not be premised on empire first around the world, but on some kind of notion of America first. And I reached back to the more sophisticated version of it that Robert Taft promulgated in the 1950s. And so naturally, the deep state was deeply alarmed, was, you know, almost panicked by the prospect that someone was coming into the Oval Office that was questioning the fundamental fallacy of the indispensable nation and, you know, the global policeman and the empire that Washington had established all around the world. But the problem is those primitive ideas, which he articulated pretty well during the campaign. He said, you know, Iraq was a disaster. He was right about that. Mm-hmm. Libya was a disaster. We shouldn't be in Syria. He rightly understood that we didn't really have a fundamental reason for a quarrel with Russia, that Putin could be dealt with, and that some rapprochement should be sought. So he was right. He even said that NATO was obsolete, and, you know, a greater truth has not been spoken in a long time on the presidential campaign trail, because it was obsolete when the, you know, Soviet Union disappeared in 1991. The reason for NATO disappeared as well, and it should have been dismantled. So he was heading in the right direction, but, you know, the neocons found, use this word delicately, his soft underbelly, okay, which is perhaps ample if you think about it. And that is his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and that whole nexus of connection to Bibi Netanyahu and what I call the two branches of the war party, the Washington branch and the Israeli branch, the Netanyahu branch. And that's where all these people come from, Bolton and Pompeo and Nikki Haley and the whole Elliot Abrams, for crying out loud. It's all part of that neocon war party and its two branches, as I've described. And so without recognizing the clashing inconsistency between his own impulses, which were well expressed during the campaign and even have, you know, manifested themselves during his presidency. I thought his summit with Putin was brilliant in Helsinki last year, and he practically, got run out of Washington for treason when he got back home. And, you know, there he's now on his way to Vietnam. I think that's very fitting that he's going to Hanoi, where we committed genocide 4 decades ago to make peace with Korea, where we never should have been 65 years ago. But, you know, they're going to undermine him. I mean, they're going to try to, erode and thwart and disable almost anything that may come out of this next summit. When you think about it, he's rightly wants to withdraw the 2,000 forces that were in Syria that never should have been there. Obama put them there, and he's not even been able to do that. Now, I mean, you know, here you have a president of the United States with an impulse to say Syria, with a GDP of 20 billion only, which is about 8 hours of U.S. GDP, no threat to us whatsoever, a totally ruined country as a result of our intervention along with the Saudis and the rest of them in this stupid battle against Assad, which was none of our business. So you have a ruined country that has never possibly threatened the United States, and he can't even get 2,000 forces out of there. They're leaving a residual force as hostages, by the way, to the war party that wants to be able to tell Assad that you can't have an alliance with the Iranians because, we decree them to be bad actors. I think it's just another case of where the impulse has been turned on its head. And now here we are, this, blatant, bald-faced intervention in the internal affairs of Venezuela, which is about the opposite of America First, if, you could think of any worse example. I mean, this is Empire First. It's not America First. And yet he's got that whole crowd around him, Pompeo especially, I find exceedingly obnoxious and stupid, by the way. Elliot Abrams, a bloodthirsty neocon who I actually had to deal with way back in the 1980s when he was in the Reagan administration. And it's almost inconceivable that someone who started out with such good ideas has ended up surrounding himself with such bad advisors and essentially allowed through their auspices the deep state to take him hostage.
Well, David, very well said, all of that. And of course, I think many people listening to this will share my own view, which was here's what's come out of this that's good. It's exposed that there's no remaining party of peace in America. It's exposed that the Democrats are just as bloodthirsty as the Republicans. It shows how whatever has taken hold of D.C. just can't possibly get enough more war. And Venezuela exposes this as much as anything. Look, I don't care if you think Maduro is a loathsome dictator or not. All you have to do is look at the last 8 or 10 or 20 regime change efforts by the United States to understand that the common people are never helped by these efforts. Yes. They're always harmed, deeply harmed. Libya is now an open slave market where it used to be the top performing BRIC in the world, if you put it on the BRIC scale. So it's been absolutely destroyed. So this party wants to destroy. We destroy as a country for interests that are difficult to articulate. And I've asked a lot of people who are saying we have to go into Venezuela. What is the vital U.S. interest on display there, or in Syria, or in Libya? What are we really doing there, and why? What are our aims? What are our objectives? Nobody knows. So what happened here? Let me ask you this. How did we get here, and how do we get away from this?
You mean generically or in the Venezuela case? But it's a good case in point.
Yeah, let's use it as a case in point.
Because, you know, the Washington establishment has got sort of a hard wing and a soft wing. And the hard wing, you know, wants to let the bombs and the missiles and the drones fly. And then there's this other group that basically says, well, let's first try economic warfare before we go to deadly military warfare, but it's the same thing. We've got sanctions, and I go over this in quite at length in the book, on 30 different countries in the world. And in addition to the sanctions on countries themselves, like we're trying to do with the Iranians right now, deny oil markets to them everywhere in the world, even though that's their fundamental source of livelihood as a nation. But we also put sanctions on individuals, government officials, private businessmen, or cronies of Putin and all the rest of them. But here's the thing. There's hundreds of thousands of individuals from nations that we've targeted as bad actors who are now under sanctions. It's the biggest exercise in economic warfare around the globe that's ever been witnessed in all of human history. And I bring this up because that's what has caused the crisis on the margin in Venezuela. Obviously, socialism doesn't work. They had the tremendous oil reserves, probably even as great as Saudi Arabia, although of much lower quality. Successive socialist governments there have blown it, so they made a pretty big mess, but it wasn't particularly our problem. But then we stepped in a year ago and started to impose sanctions that dried up their ability to engage in trade and to import food and other vital, items in cost of living, and incited the inflation that we're now saying is the reason why we need to intervene for humanitarian purposes to help the people. I mean, how many times are they going to get away with pulling this kind of thing? And this is exactly, it's almost like the playbook that they get out, and now you need heavier intervention. This is what's being said in the last few days, because the economic situation there is so terrible. I guess we never seem to learn.
Well, that seems to be the case here. I'm just glad it's exposed, at least finally, to show that it hasn't made a huge impact on a lot of the people I talked to yet, but hopefully it will soon, because as far as I can tell, America doesn't gain a lot from feeding this massive military and surveillance complex. It feels very expensive, and it feels like it's expensive at a bad time, because as I opened with, the amount of fiscal runway we've got left in this story is not a lot. And we know a recession's coming. They always happen. And so the Fed doesn't seem to have a lot of runway left. And so turning to that idea, recently Jay Powell, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, he was said to have pivoted in response to some downward pressure on stock prices in December of 2018, just a couple months ago. What word would you use to describe Jay Powell's change of heart?
Well, I think maybe capitulated would be a more honest description of what he did. I mean, how in 20 days between the Fed meeting, I think on December 19th, in which he said shrinkage of the balance sheet was on automatic pilot, mm-hmm. and interest rate normalization was you know, underway and in the train for 2019. And then by January 4th, everything was on pause, on hold. And what had been the obvious thing to do, this balance sheet was so bloated at $4.5 trillion. You know, people lose track of everything. We've got such a recency bias that I think it had been long forgotten that $4.5 trillion of balance sheet was an aberration. It was only $900 billion on the eve of the Lehman bankruptcy in September 2008. And I point out to people that it had taken 94 years to build the balance sheet of the Fed from scratch to $900 billion, 94 years. In the next 94 days, Bernanke had taken it to $2.2 trillion, up by 145%, and then they kept inventing new excuses to expand further with QE1, to the twist and all the other gimmicks they came up with. But at $4.5 trillion, we had basically engaged in massive financial fraud, because that uptick just between September 08 and when the balance sheet peaked at $4.5 trillion, you know, that $3.5 trillion gain was really involved the purchase of massive amounts of government bonds and GSE paper that had funded real, you know, claims on labor and material and capital with, you know, credits that the Fed, you know, conjured out of thin air. And the idea that you can create $3.5 trillion of buying power out of thin air in such a short period of time and not distort and warp the system, that is, drive bond prices higher and yields lower, and then all of that cascades through the nexus of pricing in the financial markets. The idea that, you know, you could get away with that indefinitely is sort of at the heart of the problem that we have today. Now, it's interesting to note that in October 2011, I'm pretty sure it was October 2011, Bernanke had addressed exactly that problem, at, you know, the massive inflation of the balance sheet then underway. Powell was on the Fed by that point in time, and Bernanke said very explicitly, no, we're not monetizing the debt, which has been a terrible financial sin since time immemorial. But this is a extraordinary circumstance, a temporary inflation, big inflation of the balance sheet, a loan to the financial system, which will then be withdrawn and liquidated once we have attained financial stability and the economy has been righted. Well, that has been the alleged intention all along. And when they finally got to October 2017, they began the shrinkage as promised, although much delayed, and at $10 billion a month. But by October 2018, that had cranked up to $50 billion a month, $600 billion a year run rate. Within 2 months, exactly what you would think might happen did happen. The financial markets began to reel under the impact of this huge cash drain that was going on, and the day of reckoning was arriving. It only took, as I said a moment ago, 14 days for Powell, you know, to completely reverse course, capitulate, and prove that really what the Fed is about is simply coddling and, you know, propping up the stock market, and the rest of it is all just window dressing. I mean, the constant talk about its Humphrey Hawkins objectives in inflation and GDP growth and all the other, you know, economic metrics they look at, this is all beside the point. They twist and turn and manipulate those to justify whatever they're doing at the moment. And what they're doing at the moment clearly is trying to keep this stock bubble, levitated as long as they possibly can. And it's obviously a losing battle. Sooner or later, you reach the point in which the last sucker has bought the last share, and then the whole thing starts to unwind. I think that's the phase we're going to be in during the next 2 years.
So you're getting to the heart of my next question, which is asking about what exactly are they so terrified of allowing financial assets to correct? So let me frame it this way, David. How bad could that next recession, or maybe I should say financial crisis, actually be? What's on the table here?
Well, I think what's on the table is a long slog at the bottom. In other words, there won't be in the financial system a V-shaped snapback like we had last time, because last time the Fed, the funds rate was at 5.25 on the eve of the crisis, and they were able to take it down to zero. The balance sheet, as I, we've been talking about, was $900 billion, and in theory, the thing could be doubled and tripled. But now they're out of dry powder. They didn't get around to normalizing, even as we are now in month 116 of this expansion. We're 3 months from the record of the 1990s, 119 months, that materialized under far more propitious circumstances. So, where we stand today is, on the precipice of the next stock market unwind, which the key point that I make in the book is that that triggers the new form of recession. In other words, 40 years ago, when the Fed got let things get out of hand and allowed credit in the business system and in the household sector to expand too rapidly, and housing market would get red hot or capital goods markets would get overheated, it would step in, raise interest rates. That would curtail credit in the Main Street economy. The economy would start to wobble. The market would see that coming, and the stock market would go down in response to an emerging and latent recession. Now, today, I think it's the opposite. What happens today is when these tremendous bubbles that are created by the Fed finally fracture, it triggers in the C-suites, corporate headquarters of American companies, a panicked effort to keep their stock price up and their option packages whole by these sweeping restructuring plans that involve huge layoffs, inventory liquidation, writing off of allegedly bad assets, writing off of the enormous hundreds of billions of goodwill that's created during the boom phase with all of this unproductive M&A activity that goes on. So the crash triggers the C-suite liquidation. We've seen that twice now this decade, and that brings about a recession that no one sees coming. And that's why I'm pretty confident that before we get to November 2020, there will have been another sequence just like 2008 and 2009, except this time without any dry powder left. It's very unlikely, in my view, that there'll be a quick snapback in the financial markets, and that the stock averages will remain, bumping along the bottom for years and years to come. And once it's clear that the Fed can't rescue the market quickly like it did in after March 2009, I think you're going to be in a totally different ball game, where finally the credibility of the Fed will come under withering assault and questioning, which couldn't happen soon enough, as far as I'm concerned.
No, it'll be long overdue. But David, let me take devil's advocate for a second here. A lot of people, I know a lot of people, many of them, very successful investors have thrown in the towel on the idea that this reality or fundamentals are ever going to come back into vogue. They think there's nothing to prevent the Fed from simply doing more this year, maybe next, the year after that. Maybe the Fed can expand their balance sheet by buying bonds again. Sure, maybe they buy stocks this time. Maybe even Beanie Babies if they think they have to. Are there really any limits on what the Fed can do here?
You know, there aren't any limits. They could buy the whole inventory of Beanie Babies that, you know, are lost out there in yard sales throughout America. But the point is, they said this was one time extraordinary, a courageous, as Bernanke called it, response to the allegedly unprecedented conditions of 2008 and after the Lehman collapse, and that it would make the economy well again. Well, it didn't. I mean, if we have another recession, we have another stock market crash, and they try the same routine, you know, you might get a momentary sort of rip in the daily trading, but I think it'll cause a profound loss of confidence in the whole central banking apparatus. You know, the whole thing's based on confidence, and because after all, it defies every notion of economic rationality and just common sense. I mean, you can't buy $3, $4, $5, $6 trillion worth of paper that has funded real activity and is a claim on real economic resources by hitting the buy button at the central bank. It's just not. I mean, if that were true, then why bother, you know, to stop where the central banks did? In other words, as I also lay out a little more in the book, the Fed is only the leader of the gang in this whole thing. Mm-hmm. And if you take all the central banks in the late 1990s, the balance sheet of central banks was $2 trillion. By 2004, they'd gotten that up to about $4 trillion. Today, it's $25 trillion, okay? Mm-hmm. So in less than two decades, central banks combined around the world manufactured $21 trillion worth of balance sheet. That is real assets they bought with fiat credits they conjured from thin air. And that's what's created a massive disorder in pricing distortion in the global financial system. But if you believe that the Fed can do it, then all the rest of them are going to as well, because, you know, that's why everybody else expanded their balance sheet, because otherwise they felt these countries felt, particularly the mercantilist exporters of East Asia, that their currencies would appreciate, their export industries would be harmed. And so they just joined the Fed's money printing parade through foreign, you know, FX intervention and building up their balance sheets of dollars. But, you know, the point I'm getting at is that if the Fed tries to do it again, everybody else will. And so the question is, do you really think that you could have a $40 trillion central bank balance sheet in the world or an $80 trillion central bank balance sheet in the world when the whole GDP of the world is only $80 trillion today? You know, it's not possible. It's irrational. It's magical thinking. And when you ask the question, it's hard to give a precise scenario of what will happen. But what will happen eventually can't be good, or, you know, the whole world has been wrong about what economies are about and how wealth is created for centuries and centuries. Because if this were all possible, everybody should stop working and the central bank should dump money from the sky every Thursday afternoon at 4 o'clock people pick up their money and have fun for the next week. I mean, this can't work.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's exactly what's on offer, and it's my final question.
I know,
here,
that's MMT.
MMT, yeah, right. So take that apart for
that's
us, would you?
That's the next step. I mean, that's the next step. When you have adults out there, with a straight face proposing, well, let's not bother with QE, because that put the minted money, the fiat money or credit, into Wall Street dealers, who then, you know, sold the bonds and repurchased some stock, and there was an indirect process of allegedly wealth effects that produced a boom on Wall Street but didn't do a lot for Main Street. That's pretty obvious. And I have one fact in the book I'd just like to throw in here, which I think is overwhelming, and that is, if you go back to the pre-crisis peak, late 2007, and look at the NASDAQ 100, which has been the leading edge of this bubble, the tech sector, actually adjust the index for inflation, in real terms, it's up 200%. And I'm not talking about from the bottom in March 2009. I'm talking about the prior peak. It's up 200%, whereas industrial production is up 3%. Labor hours consumed by the U.S. economy from the prior peak are up only 6%. And real household median income is up zero. So if Main Street is, you know, up 0 to 6%, and Wall Street in the same, real terms is up 200%, there's something fundamentally wrong. It was like a totally lopsided, bifurcated recovery that will be pretty obvious once the next recession sets in. And then you get these MMT people coming along and saying, well, the mistake was they pumped the money through Wall Street. Let's just pass it out directly to every citizen or householder in America. I mean, that's essentially that's true helicopter money, but they'd probably use FedEx to deliver it rather than, actual helicopters. This is insanity. And almost every discussion I get into now, what about MMT? I mean, it shows you how far financial literacy has been degraded or corrupted by this kind of Keynesian central banking that's gotten worse and worse and worse by the year, by the month, and practically by the day. We can see that right now, where we have this new theory that our inflation targeting was quite slightly miscast, because instead of 2% change per year, we should be targeting the price level, the kind of PCE deflator level, index level, so that if we fall short 1 year, we have the right to make it up the next year. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, there's not a shred of evidence that says 2% inflation is better than 5% or 0% or -2%. And yet we've now reached the point where these are almost like medieval theologians counting angels on the head of a pin, saying we've got to go to price level targeting. Why? Because then they can print more money. I mean, that's the essence of it. It's totally irrational. Everything they're talking about. By the way, another thing I address in the book is, as part of this whole discussion, this thing called R-Star. Now, when people have to start talking in such obscurantist terms, something is up. But R-Star, they can't even call it the neutral rate of interest. That's what it means. They got to have some, obscure symbol so that if you're not part of the priesthood, you don't know what they're talking about. But anyway, that the natural rate of interest is somehow half what it used to be. This the guy that Trump put on there, Clarida, who was head of the Economics Department of Columbia and an advisor to PIMCO, so you can see where he's coming from, has basically said recently, well, we used to think the R-Star was 4%, now we think it's 2%. Well, if R-Star is 2%, and of course it's totally a made-up thing, it's invisible, it's a theoretical nothing burger that they made up. The only real interest rate is what supply and demand in the free market would produce, obviously. But if they're now saying we need to have 2% inflation come hell or high water, because that's what price targeting, price level targeting is all about, and we're going to lower our money market target to 2%. They're basically saying money should be free forever, as far as the eye can see, world without end until time immemorial. I mean, this is what these alleged adults on the Federal Reserve are now saying.
Well, so, dude, it absolutely boggles my mind. And I think the critical point you said a few minutes ago, which is that money is it's not a real thing. It's a medium of exchange. It's a claim
right.
on real things. And so there always has to be a balance between real stuff and then how you're going to denote that in your markers, which we'll call money for the moment. And it seems to me like the MMT people have it upside down. They think that money is the source of wealth. And as long as you have the money flowing out, you've got real wealth flowing out. But didn't the Romans try this? Hasn't everybody who's ever tried to clip a coin or print a few extra bills? Isn't this what Venezuela is trying to do? I fundamentally don't grasp where they think the source of wealth actually originates from, because it doesn't come from money. That's a claim on wealth. It's not real wealth.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you dig, unpeel the onion, I mean, what are they really saying? Well, they're saying you can print as much money as you want until you get too much inflation, because you've overtaxed the capacity of labor and industry to produce goods and services. But until you reach that point, you can print all the money you want, because they don't see it as money. They see it as demand. Okay. But the underlying, assumption is that people are too damn stupid to know that they're wealthy and they should be spending more money. Okay. And so, therefore you need the central bank, to make it clear, you know, to hit the mule between the eyes with a 2x4 by dumping money out of the sky. Well, you know, this is nonsense. I'm a Say's Law man. I believe production is production is a source of income. Income is a source of demand. If you haven't produced it, you can't swap it, trade it, exchange it, mm-hmm. or buy it. But you know, people used to know that. I mean, 100 years ago, everybody knew that, from the lowest bank teller to whatever professors of economics we had at the time. Today, they don't even know it at the central bank, and they're in charge of the money. So, you know, so what I guess I'm saying is, it's not surprising that MMT has come along, because it's just a slightly exaggerated, extended version of what the central bankers are doing today.
So it sounds like a post facto sort of rationalization. Hey, look, it's worked so far. Let's just keep doing that, but let's just, you know, redirect it this way instead of that way. David, given all of this, how should individuals prepare themselves financially for what's coming?
Well, I think you have to recognize that the stock market and the bond market are dangerous places, because they have been totally distorted, falsified, bloated, by central bank policies that can't be sustained. And, there's no easy answer to this except to recognize that in certain times of history, capital preservation is the number one, number two, and number three objective, and you worry about capital appreciation later, but you got to be prepared for the crisis. And I think, therefore, you stay liquid. And I do believe that as central banking fails, we get the next market crash, the next recession, the central bankers are going to be totally discredited, because they said, people like me and others, and even the Washington politicians are going to say, you said if we do all this, QEs and all the rest of it, and interest rates on the floorboard, that it's all going to work out for the best, and here we are back in the soup again. So I think they're going to be discredited, and on the margin, the fast money traders are going to look for some asset that they think can weather the storm, and that's likely to be gold. So I think gold is going to, you know, have a resurgence. I can't say how much or how soon, but gold is the one asset that central bankers can't manipulate, create, or destroy. And that is going to become, you know, a very valuable attribute and give it a premium value as central banking, Keynesian-style central banking, falls apart.
Well, with a pro tip for sovereign nations who happen to be listening in, just don't store your gold in London if you want to have access to it when you need it.
Right, exactly.
Seems like we should have learned that by now. Well, everybody, we've been speaking with David Stockman, author of Peak Trump, The Undrainable Swamp and the Fantasy of MAGA. We've barely touched on the tip of the iceberg of all the incredible information that's in there. I have a ton of questions I didn't even get to. But get the book, read it, be prepared for what's coming next. David, thank you so much for your time today.
Very good. And we'll continue the conversation because, you know, as I say in the book, we're truly in uncharted waters. And the only way you can navigate this is to basically shed the recency bias and all of the financial and monetary fantasy that's been conjured up in the last decade or so. Go back to basics and recognize, you know, the fantasy land that we're in for what it is, and then take prudent steps accordingly.
Absolutely. Very well said. Well, thanks again for your time, and we will continue this conversation.
Terrific.